Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, June 20th, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss two recently decided Supreme Court cases. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome two guests, one a new guest and one a returning guest. We'll hear first opening remarks from Michael R. Houston. He's Associate Attorney at the Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher Law Firm right here in Washington, D.C. He's going to talk about what has become the Mattal versus Tam case. Started out as Lee versus Tam, but that's the copyright case decided yesterday. After his opening remarks, we'll hear opening remarks from Ilya Shapiro. He's the Senior Fellow in Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute. He'll be talking about the Packingham case. That's the North Carolina redistricting case, also decided just yesterday. So this is unusual for us, where we're talking about two cases on one call, but we'll try and keep things straight. After those opening remarks, we'll open the floor to questions for either of our experts on either of the cases. With that, Michael Houston, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Dean, and thanks to the Federalist Society for having me. This case concerns the Supreme Court's growing and popular dance rock band docket. It's a case about the First Amendment. So the case concerns the disparagement provision of the Lanham Act for the registration of federal trademarks. The court ultimately struck down the statute 8-0. Justice Gorsuch did not participate. The case got lots of attention because it will have a direct impact on the Washington Redskins' ability to retain their own trademark. They had parallel litigation that was running at the same time. And as I mentioned, although the result of the case is unanimous, the reasoning is divided, and several important portions of the opinion don't have a majority or even a plurality. I co-authored an amicus brief in support of Mr. Tam for the Chamber of Commerce of the United States in this case, but my comments today here are just mine alone. Ilya Shapiro, who I'm pleased to be joined with on this call, also wrote an amicus brief for the Cato Institute, and I think you will enjoy reading his if you haven't already. Simon Tam was the respondent in this case. He's the lead singer of a dance rock band called The Slants. He and his bandmates are Asian American, and they chose that name deliberately in order to reclaim that racial slur. Some of their songs challenge stereotypes about Asian Americans. Mr. Tam applied for but was denied a trademark for The Slants because of the Lanham Act's disparagement provision, which is 15 U.S. Code 1052A. It prohibits the registration of a trademark that, quote, may disparage persons living or dead, institutions, beliefs, or national symbols, or bring them into contempt or disrepute. It didn't matter to the PTO that Mr. Tam's intent for his mark was not to disparage. It was enough that a substantial number of persons could perceive the mark to be disparaging. Tam appealed to the Federal Circuit, which, sitting en banc, held that the disparagement provision was unconstitutional. And then the Supreme Court took the case. In the unanimous portion of the Supreme Court's opinion, the court first dealt with a brief statutory argument that the disparagement provision didn't actually reach Mr. Tam's mark because he argued it didn't apply to groups, disparagement of groups as opposed to persons. The court made quick work of that, and you can consult the opinion if you're particularly interested in that statutory holding. But the bulk of the opinion is dedicated to the court's ultimate holding that the statute violates the First Amendment. In the unanimous portion, the court rejected the government's argument, the lead argument, that trademarks are government speech rather than private speech. The Supreme Court's doctrine has long held that when the government is speaking, it has fairly wide latitude, and the sort of protections of the First Amendment that normally operate on the government don't apply. The court said here, importantly, that it will, quote, exercise great caution before extending its government speech precedence, because if private speech could be passed off as government speech simply by affixing a government seal of approval, then that would be an opportunity for the government to silence or muffle disfavored viewpoints. And just as a brief aside, this portion of the opinion could actually be quite significant to future cases. We've seen litigation in recent months around the country where the government has attempted to mandate certain statements and then say, for example, brought to you by the city of San Francisco. And I think this opinion is a rebuke of the idea that the government can label a message as its own and then cure any First Amendment difficulty. So back to the opinion. The court said that it was far-fetched, quote, to suggest that the content of trademarks is government speech. The government doesn't dream up these messages or edit them, and the court called attention to the enormously wide range of things that have been registered as federal trademarks, many of which, as highlighted in various briefs that were filed with the court, are really quite unseemly. It simply makes no sense to say that the government is the author of all of these messages. As Justice Alito, the author of the portion of the opinion, put it, if the government is speaking through trademarks, then it is, quote, babbling prodigiously and incoherently. One of the government's main arguments on this point was the recent case Walker v. Sons of Confederate Veterans, decided a few years ago, which held that Texas's specialty license plate program was government speech rather than private speech. But the court said that likely marks the outer bounds of the government speech doctrine, and it said that trademarks are unlike specialty license plates in basically every respect that matters. They have not been historically used by the government to convey messages. They're not closely aligned in the mind of the public with the state. The last sort of point on this was that if trademarks were government speech, then copyright registrations would likely also be, but even the government did not argue that it could refuse to copyright a work on the ground that it disparaged particular persons. The remainder of the court's opinion, as I mentioned, was divided, and no portion gathered a majority of the court. The court responded to the government's arguments that the trademark program is just a subsidy program, and that trademarks are merely commercial speech that are entitled to less First Amendment protection. So Justice Alito's opinion for four justices, which was joined by the Chief Justice, Justice Thomas, and Justice Breyer, first rejected the argument that trademarks are a permissible limitation on government subsidies for speech, similar to the programs that were upheld in cases like Rust v. Sullivan or NEA v. Finley. Justice Alito said that all of those cases involved cash subsidies or their equivalents, and they are not applicable to more broadly programs like trademarks, fishing licenses, or driver's licenses. Justice Alito similarly rejected the government's argument that this case is analogous to cases where the government has approved limitations on public where the court has approved limitations on public employers' ability to collect union dues for employees. Justice Alito's opinion said those too are just subsidy cases. They confer a substantial benefit to serve a particular purpose. Whereas here, the government was creating a broad registration system for a wide range of views. Justice Alito also rejected an argument that the government had established a permissible, quote, limited public forum with the trademark system. Even in such a forum, the longstanding doctrine is that viewpoint discrimination is prohibited. And Justice Alito's opinion concluded that this anti-disparagement provision is an instance of viewpoint discrimination, because giving offense is a viewpoint, in the words of the court. Laws that prohibit expression because they are likely to offend are unconstitutional and have been for centuries under Supreme Court precedent. And then the last portion of Justice Alito's opinion addressed the government's argument that trademarks are commercial speech and so only receive relaxed First Amendment scrutiny. Justice Alito found it unnecessary to decide this question because he said the disparagement provision would fail even the lesser commercial speech standard of review under Central Hudson. The asserted interests that the government had put forward in things like preventing minority groups from being bombarded with demeaning messages and advertising, Justice Alito's opinion described that as just another way of saying that the government seeks to prohibit messages that offend, which strikes at the heart of the First Amendment. The other important opinion in the case was for Justice Kennedy, also for four justices, joined by Justices Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Justice Kennedy agreed that this provision is viewpoint discrimination, which triggers, quote, rigorous constitutional scrutiny. And in light of that holding, he believed it was unnecessary to have an extended discussion of the other arguments. He rejected, in his opinion, several of the government's arguments that this was not an instance of viewpoint discrimination, including, for example, the government argued this was not viewpoint discrimination because it applied to all negative expressions of opinion, regardless of the topic. And Justice Kennedy said that would allow, if that were constitutional, then the government could have a law that banned criticizing all politicians, but that clearly would be inconsistent with the First Amendment. As mentioned, Justice Kennedy found it unnecessary to resolve whether trademarks are commercial speech. He said, however that issue is resolved, the viewpoint-based discrimination at issue here necessarily invokes heightened scrutiny. He rejected the argument that this was a government speech or that it was a permissible government subsidy, and ultimately said, because that viewpoint discrimination remains a serious concern, even in the commercial context. Justice Thomas had a very short, separate opinion to say, to reiterate his view made in prior cases, that when the government seeks to restrict truthful ideas based on their message, strict scrutiny applies regardless of the commercial context. So I think to put all of these opinions together, the first thing that we have is a very strong rebuke of viewpoint discrimination. The court is not going to allow the government to evade the longstanding prohibition on viewpoint discrimination by recharacterizing its regulatory program. And it's sending a very strong message that the government may not engage in viewpoint discrimination and prohibit speech, no matter how offensive it is. I think the biggest open question that remains after this opinion concerns the commercial speech doctrine. The court's fractured opinion in the case, combined with the lack of the decision about what is commercial speech and Justice Kennedy's lack of precision about what standard of review applies, means that there's not nearly as much clarification of that doctrine as many practitioners have hoped for. Lawyers who argue First Amendment cases, especially in the commercial speech area, do, I think, have several new arguments to make in order to attack government regulations based on this opinion. But given the fact that it's a largely 4-4 opinion, and that, again, there is some, that several important questions in the case the court simply set aside because it considered this case fairly easy and straightforward, means that it's less clear than we might have hoped how lower courts will apply this going forward. I'll look forward to answering questions, but with that, I want to turn it over to Ilya to talk about Packingham.
Well, great. Thanks, Michael. I'm pretty sure that our brief in the case is the first one to have ever filed a full-color beer label in a Supreme Court brief. I haven't done the full research, but I'm staking that claim. Would love to be proven wrong. So the case that I'm discussing, Packingham versus North Carolina, Dean misspoke. It's not a redistricting case, although it seems like everything out of North Carolina is some sort of political law case, but not this one. This turned out to be a rather straightforward case. Also unanimous, 8-0, although the majority opinion by Kennedy, joined by the more liberal justices, and then a concurrence by Alito, joined by Chief and Justice Thomas. I'll go into that in a moment. Not really differing on rationale, but differing on what Alito calls undisciplined dicta. He kind of faults Kennedy's flowery prose, I suppose. This case involves the First Amendment rights of sex offenders. If you recall the teleforum that I did after argument, it seemed like Mr. Packingham was going to win, but unclear exactly how and what the rule would be, that sort of thing. You could appreciate why someone could be skeptical, because after all, sex offenders are the most marginalized group in society, ahead only of cannibals, I suppose. So it has to be the rare case where the Supreme Court rules unanimously in their favor. And this is not a situation where some state decreed that anyone accused of a sex crime be chemically castrated without trial or any other kind of Eighth Amendment or due process claim. Instead, here, Lester Packingham, a man who served his time and was released subject to the normal set of registration and living restrictions, was sent back to prison because he accessed Facebook. So again, all eight justices held that this violated the First Amendment. So diving into the bizarre facts of the case, Packingham had served time for, quote, taking liberties with a minor when he was 21 and she was 13. Unrelated to that, he beat a parking ticket and then celebrated by proclaiming on his Facebook page, God is good, praise be to God, wow, thanks Jesus. So no religious free exercise claim on this one, purely a speech one. But nevertheless, for this grave offense against humanity, he was returned to the big house under a North Carolina statute that bans such people from accessing a wide variety of websites. And the law was clearly meant to prevent communications between sex offenders and minors. But it sweeps much more broadly than any other such law in the country. Here's how it reads. North Carolina law makes it a felony for registered sex offenders, quote, to access a commercial social networking website where the sex offender knows that the site permits minor children to become members or to create or maintain personal web pages. And the Supreme Court found that this law was not narrowly tailored to serve a significant governmental interest. Translating from the legalese, this means that the state legislature slapped down a broad law that didn't closely track the social problem that it was supposed to target. As the court explained, and it cited my brief, Cato joined with the ACLU on an amicus brief here, the law, as I just read to you, could be used to bar access not only to things like Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn, what have you, but to any site where someone creates a profile and interacts with people. And that includes Amazon, YouTube, WebMD. That WebMD seems to be a popular example, both in the majority and in the concurrence, although I myself, I admit, have not ever used it, or even the Washington Post or New York Times. I mean, think about it. To log in to one of these sites, you set up a type of profile. I mean, it's not a detailed sort of profile like in Facebook, but you do that, and then you exchange comments. It fits under the rubric of that law. But even restrictions on social media alone would be troubling, the court held in Kennedy's majority opinion, if they weren't further tailored. Kennedy's opinion is really an encomium to the importance of web surfing. Quote, by prohibiting sex offenders from using those websites, North Carolina, with one broad stroke, bars access to what for many are the principal sources for knowing current events, checking ads for employment, speaking and listening in the modern public square, and otherwise exploring the vast realms of human thought and knowledge. So I guess this is a practice tip. The next time your spouse tells you that you're spending too much time on Facebook or Twitter, you can reply that you're simply enriching yourself with the wealth of human knowledge, citing Kennedy's opinion in Packingham. And there are other problems with the statute that the court sort of notes in passing, like its vagueness. People don't even know what they can or can't do that are subject to this. The police themselves aren't exactly sure. And the statute fails constitutional scrutiny because it criminalizes speech based on the identity of the speaker. As Kennedy put it, quote, even convicted criminals, and in some instances especially convicted criminals, might receive legitimate benefits from these means for access to the world of ideas, in particular if they seek to reform and to pursue lawful and rewarding lives. And indeed, the very purpose of the First Amendment is to protect unpopular speech by disfavored minorities. Singling out this speech for prosecution without any allegation that it relates to conduct or even motive has now earned the Tar Heel State a big dislike from the Supreme Court. And just a moment on the Alito concurrence. Again, as I said, he just quibbles that Kennedy has this encomium, as I've called it, to Facebook and the wonders of the internet age and so forth. And he wants to make clear that this doesn't stop states from passing much more narrowly tailored laws. Here's from Alito's concurrence, the court is unable to resist musings that seem to equate the entirety of the internet with public streets and parks. And this language is bound to be interpreted by some to mean that the states are largely powerless to restrict even the most dangerous sexual predators from visiting any internet sites, including, for example, teenage dating sites and sites designed to permit minors to discuss personal problems with their peers. I mean, I think that's making a bit too much of what Kennedy does. In any event, I think the court is clear. Even though the justices are generally very circumspect in terms of making sweeping pronouncements about the intersection of technology and constitutional law, because these things tend to be a moving target, and who knows what the shape of social media or communications or what have you might be in 5 or 10 years. But still, it seems pretty clear that the narrow tailoring point is hammered home. A state certainly can, and indeed every other state does, restrict communications between released sex offenders and minors without this kind of blanket ban on accessing most internet sites, or at least most that have any element of interactivity. So I will leave it there and look forward to your questions.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either of our experts on either of the cases, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, you can refer to them by name or refer to the cases, or we'll figure it out. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got plenty of time left for questions. While we wait to see if anyone rings in, a reminder about our upcoming schedule. Our next scheduled Teleform conference call is tomorrow at 2 p.m. We'll be discussing the foundations of the Chevron deference. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. at this same number. Again, if you have a question today, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. I'll get things started as we wait for the audience to spring to life with a question for Michael Houston. Michael, every coverage I've read, new media coverage I've read of this case, and indeed your own presentation, sort of begins or at least prominently says that the band here, the Slants, was trying to reclaim the racial slur, sort of getting to their motives or their ideas in adopting this band name. But then in your analysis here, it seems to me that it doesn't. Their motives don't really matter here under the court's reasoning. Have I got that correct?
I think that is correct. It was the court mentions the fact in its opinion that some of the things that people have applied to get trademarks for that have been invalidated under the disparagement provision are really quite awful. And it is a necessary and inevitable consequence and foreseeable consequence of this opinion that people will be able to get trademarks on really, really awful things. I think the court's view really unanimously is that is the price that we pay for having a First Amendment and living in a free society. But yes, the court, it was true before this opinion that the intent of the speaker in using their mark really was irrelevant to whether it was found to be disparaging. What mattered was whether a substantial group of people were likely to perceive it to be disparaging. But that's the statute that has been struck down, and it will apply equally to trademarks that are really awful.
Right.
And if I can add to that, there was an amicus brief that proposed a test that would look into motives. So the Slants would be okay because they're taking it back. The Redskins or someone else would not because they're allegedly disparaging someone else rather than reappropriating or what have you. But that really makes for an unworkable test. You have judges trying to be mind readers, and what if it's a close case? How do you determine who's to judge? Do you have to do a full cultural survey and make a legal judgment about the meaning of the First Amendment based on that? It really doesn't work. I mean, once the court determined that this was not government speech. I mean, that was it. And of course, you know, I didn't think that it would do anything else. If you look at the Redskins amicus brief, they have an appendix that's, I think, 19 pages long that lists registered, accepted trademarks that are much more offensive, many of them, than the slants is.
Well, Ilya Shapiro, in reaching its decision, did the court discuss that one amicus brief and reject it, or just not even go there in terms of its discussion?
Michael, I don't know if you recall it. I don't think it did.
No, they did.
Did they? Okay.
They did, yeah. Justice Alito's opinion at least cited to Lisa Blatt's brief for the Redskins and that appendix.
I meant the brief that suggested that judges ought to look behind the motive.
That brief wasn't discussed, but I think the Justice Alito's opinion did make a similar point to the one Ilya just made about the indeterminacy that a test like that the disparagement provision actually as actually applied produced, and why that was problematic.
Right. Very good. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We'll start today with three questions. Let's take our first call. Go ahead, caller. If you have your phone on mute, you need to take your telephone off mute.
Hello, this is John Hsu. Hello, Ilya, Michael. One question that I have is, it seems like a lot of the justices, certainly enough for a 5-vote, agreed on the basic principle that the PTO could not objectively make decisions on what was offensive or what was not offensive. And so I was wondering if you could dig deeper, please, and describe why the court's reasoning was split into so many different parts.
That's a really good question, and I thought a lot about it since the opinion came down. I don't have a great answer for it. It is surprising in some ways because, as you say, so much of there is so much agreement between the two opinions.
Yep.
That it's really surprising that they could not come up with 5 justices to agree on one particular opinion. I think if you had to sort out what is the literally controlling holding, it's probably Justice Kennedy's opinion combined with Justice Thomas's on the right way to proceed, because Kennedy's view is this is viewpoint discrimination, and so the government loses. And Justice Thomas's view is that anytime, as I mentioned, anytime the government attempts to restrict truthful speech, strict scrutiny applies. It's not clear whether Justice Kennedy means to withhold strict scrutiny and say something less. It certainly seems like he's trying to apply something more than ordinary commercial speech, central Hudson scrutiny. But I think if you had to actually say what are the 5 votes that hold together on the analysis, that's the answer. But as to why they couldn't come up with an agreement, I'm surprised too, and I don't have a great answer.
Yeah, there's a lot of overlap, and it could be that the court didn't want to splinter further its description of who joins, you know, Part 3A and 2B and all, because that was already a mishmash as it was. But there are plenty of parts of Kennedy's opinion that mesh with something that Alito said. And so even if there was, you know, even if the Kennedy plurality thought that Alito's discussion of commercial speech was superfluous, I think that still leaves enough to say, well, it's not government speech, and the government is censoring it without good reason. I mean, that's a very broad general statement. So whether you lean on it being heightened or strict or any type of scrutiny, but it just doesn't pass any level of scrutiny and the government is not acting properly. I'm not sure you need really more than that. I mean, I think Alito's discussion of most of the parts that kind of strangely that the Kennedy group doesn't join are responding to the government's argument. It's not even kind of articulating a new rationale for a rule that the court is trying to establish, but it's responding to some of the government's arguments. And the court doesn't really need to respond to arguments. It can just set out what it's saying. But the upshot is the Alito part on how this is not government speech, how trademarks don't mean government endorsement or subsidy, combined with that this is improper, probably because it's viewpoint discrimination or some other. I mean, at a certain point, the magic words don't matter. But Alito also said that this is allows happy talk alone, which is the same thing as saying viewpoint discriminatory. So I don't know if we need to parse things that much. The next time we get a statute that's setting aside again the commercial speech question, but the next time we get a statute that who knows in what realm where it's not government speech and yet the government is making restrictions, I think the court will make short shrift of it no matter how you kind of paper it up with the legalese.
That's probably right. Let me follow up with one other point, which is it may well be that the commercial speech issue is the thing that prompted Kennedy and his group to write separately, because that really is a very difficult area of First Amendment law. And there is a lot of controversy in lower courts right now about what standard of scrutiny applies and whether the Supreme Court means to change it and what happens if it's a statute that affects commercial speech, but it's also viewpoint based. And I think Justice Kennedy has some strongly held views on those issues. He's written before about them, including in the Sorrell case, which features prominently in his opinion. So if I had to guess what it was that prompted him to withhold a join from a portion of Justice Alito's opinion and write separately, it would be concern for the commercial speech issues.
Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call. Go ahead, caller. If you have your telephone on mute from area code 724, you need to come off mute.
Hi, this is Brooke calling. I have a question with respect to Mattel versus Tam. As we know, the decision has essentially stricken down the disparagement clause of Section 2A of the Lanham Act. I want to know your opinion on whether and how this will impact the remaining clauses of that provision with respect to scandalous, immoral, and deceptive trademarks.
So the court specifically declined to address that question, but my view is that it is those clauses almost certainly will fall, and for exactly the same reasons. So I think in short order, to the extent that those clauses are applied by the PTO going forward, the Federal Circuit will invalidate them, and I doubt if the Supreme Court would even take the case again. I think in part for the reasons that Ilya mentioned in his comment in response to the last caller, there's just no principled way for the government to be in the business of sorting out what is immoral and what's not. And any time you have the government asking those questions, I think that it is inevitably going to result in viewpoint discrimination under the reasoning of all eight justices, really, in this opinion in Mattel. And so I think that those provisions will almost certainly be struck down.
Does that include a provision on deceptive trademarks? And by that, if so, does that include something that's made to look like another trademark? And is that a different answer?
I think it's definitely a different answer. Yeah, I should have clarified that. For deceptive speech, and that is something that was specifically that was separately mentioned by Justice Kennedy, that they were not dealing with anything like that here. That, I think, is a sort of classic function of the trademark system. The trademark system exists in order to serve as a means to identify goods and services correctly and easily, and preventing deception in that context, especially when it comes to preventing deception that's aimed at sort of surreptitiously co-opting someone else's mark. That is, it seems to me, a sort of very classic function of the trademark system, and doesn't raise nearly the same sort of First Amendment concerns. Although, and in other contexts of First Amendment law, deceptive speech is subject to much more limited First Amendment protection. Sometimes it's banned outright, and other times it's the government has much more latitude to regulate it. So I think a ban on deceptive trademarks will continue to operate the same way it largely has. But I think the immoral and slanderous provisions, scandalous provisions, will fall.
Terrific. Good. Thank you for that clarification. We've got three questions pending, so let's carry on.
Hi. I was wondering if you thought that there would be any broader implications beyond this particular section to Supreme Court declaration that trademarks are not government speech. Are there any other areas that declaration would sort of carry over into and have implications? And then also, would that carry over into other forms of IP, like, for example, patents? Is it now sort of the law of the land that patents are also not considered government speech, and do you think that would have any implications in that area of law as well?
So to take the questions, I think, in reverse order, I do think the court is of the view that patents, copyrights, other things are not government speech. And if there were an equivalent provision in a patent context or a copyright context or other areas of intellectual property, it would be unconstitutional for the same reasons. That being said, I don't know of anything really like that. And I think in the various briefs, I'm not aware of the parties really calling out other provisions that they expect would fall based on similar reasoning. But I do think more broadly, as I mentioned in my opening comments, that the court is narrowing what constitutes government speech. The Walker decision was alarming to many advocates of the First Amendment because they thought that it marked an expansion of the government speech doctrine and thus a cutback in First Amendment protection. The court is signaling, it said explicitly, that Walker really marks the outer boundary. And so I do think that portion of the opinion was unanimous. So I would expect to see the court not look kindly on arguments moving forward that various types of things are government speech other than those that have been traditionally treated as government speech.
There were actually dueling briefs on other IP. I believe supporting the slants and kind of making the analogy between trademark and patent and especially copyright, I think it was Greg Dolan, the University of Baltimore, led a law professor brief. And on the other side, I think it might have been Rebecca Tushnet, but I could be wrong about that. Could be something else. But anyway, that discussion was held among Amici. And surprisingly, I don't remember the details again. I'm just a simple constitutional lawyer, not an IP expert. But it can actually come up even in the patent area. But you're right. Basically, the rule that comes out of this with respect to government speech is merely registering something that someone created with the government does not transform it into government speech.
We still have three questions pending. We still got plenty of time left. If you'd like to join, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Yeah, hi. My question is for either of the speakers. Implicit in this call is that these two cases may have something to do with each other beyond the fact they were decided on the same day and involve the same provision. And I'm just wondering, at a high level of generality, do you think that these two cases taken together illustrate anything, portend anything? Are they consistent with one another or not?
Who wants to take a first shot at that?
Go ahead, Ilya.
Can you sharpen it a bit? I'm sorry.
Say that again?
Can you just like sharpen the question?
Well,
a bit?
We've got two cases the same day about the First Amendment, and one could imagine that, you know, if one was going to try and draw some larger conclusions about the Roberts Court and the First Amendment, do these cases, you know, align? Do they reveal anything?
The Roberts
more
Court
broadly, are they consistent with each other in terms at a broad level of generality?
Yeah. The Roberts Court has been broadly very protective of the First Amendment, whether we're dealing with Animal Crush videos or the Stolen Valor Act or, funeral protest picketing. It comes up again and again and again. Where they're divided on First Amendment questions is campaign finance and kind of in the labor area. And we'll see that again probably next term. There's been a cert petition filed in the Janus case, which is kind of the second coming of Friedrichs. But more broadly in kind of bread and butter First Amendment cases, there's Walker is really an outlier. And that came as a big surprise, the Confederate license plate case. And there, recall, it was kind of Breyer doing a sort of balancing test and calling a license plate to be a limited public forum, and therefore it is effectively government speech, even though you get to put on what's on there and things like that. Kind of a weird – and Thomas joined. Kennedy did not join. Kennedy is the most pro-First Amendment justice that – we possibly have ever had, more even than Hugo Black or anyone who kind of styled themselves as being an absolutist on the First Amendment. So, this is all of a kind, and certainly going into argument and coming out, you wouldn't necessarily have predicted that they would be unanimous. But I think the smart money would be that this court would easily sustain the First Amendment challenges.
I agree with that. I think the only other thing I would add is that there is a marked difference between the way that the Supreme Court looks at free speech and what seems to be the increasingly prevalent approach to the freedom of speech on at least American university campuses. There are certainly those who believe and who say that the use of things like racial slurs is a form of violence against racial and ethnic minorities, and that it really has to be restricted in some ways, if not suppressed altogether. And that is no longer a fringe viewpoint, I think, at least among young people, but that is really has just been decidedly rejected by every sitting justice on the Supreme Court. So to the extent that there is a trend line in public opinion, which I hope that there is not, but to the extent that there is an increasing belief that, for example, hate speech is not free speech, the Supreme Court is really here saying, yes, it is. And they're saying that unanimously and forcefully.
We are working our way through the questions here. We have two questions pending. Let's take another call. Now, the caller at area code 310, if you're on mute, you need to take your phone off mute.
Sorry, my question was asked and answered. Thank you.
All right, very good. We've got one question pending. If you'd like to join the queue at this point, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We still got about 15 minutes left. Star button, then pound button.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking the time to put the call on. My name is Don Padue. I'm a lawyer in practice in D.C., but I live in the wine country of California, and that's going to be relevant. My question regards TAM and the application of the opinion to labeling laws. For example, there is a federal statute that requires all producers of wine to submit their labels to TTB for pre-approval, and TTB will not approve a label if it has truthful assertions on it, such as a state bottled or a state grown, that TTB has decided are markers of quality, unless there are other statements also on the label. For example, the American Vintners Association area where the grapes were grown or bottled. Would either of you like to speculate on how the TAM case might apply to labeling laws such as that one?
Well, I will say that. Sorry. Oh, go ahead.
Well, one of my amicus clients in our brief was Flying Dog Brewery, who are big supporters of the First Amendment, and they've had lots of battles over beer labeling, which I imagine is somewhat similar to wine labeling, although without the geographic denominations, although sometimes. And the difference, I think the distinction in the law will turn on whether something is objective or subjective, in the sense that, as we've covered, whether something is disparaging or annoying, frustrating, offensive, these sorts of emotion cues, that sort of restriction or regulation won't be allowed. But objective ones, whether it's truth in advertising or, if I'm understanding your example correctly, that to say a state bottled, you have to indicate which estate or where it came from, something like that, as long as it's not unduly onerous, like, you know, it has to be in 60-point font and larger than, you know, the actual whatever, you know, things like that, I think might pass muster at least under this kind of review. So, you know, that also goes to the question that was asked about other provisions in the same laws, because other than this disparaging and then the scandalous and morally, you know, immoral, all that, the rest of the standards are objective. They're, you know, you can't call something champagne if it's not from the Champagne area. You can't use a living person's name without his permission. All these kind of very kind of objective criteria. And to the extent, so again, you know, there could be gray areas. There could be tough calls in the wine labeling issue. But I think that's the way that a court would analyze it.
I think Justice Kennedy is aware of the fact that product labeling laws raise particular questions, because he specifically has a sentence in his opinion carving those out and saying nothing here I'm saying deals with product labeling or other restrictions that are aimed at protecting consumers. That doesn't mean that the rules are limitless, and I think we are seeing in several cases, some of which I'm involved in, I represent the CTIA, Association of Wireless Providers, in a case in Berkeley, which has tried to require cell phone manufacturers to put a label on their product saying essentially that cell phones emit dangerous radiation and you have to, and a safety warning, which is completely misleading. So I think there are issues that are going to come up in that area in future cases, about what at the intersection of the commercial speech doctrine and other areas of First Amendment law that will really test what it is the government can say. And in particular, I hope and expect that the court will stop something that I think has been an emerging trend, which is government trying to smuggle in criticism of various types of products or viewpoints under the heading of, you know, commercial regulation.
Thank you both for that. Once again, we've got about 10 minutes. We've got one question on the board. If you'd like to ask the last question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call now.
Hello. Just another question about how much impact do you think the justices considered on the fact that the PTO could be argued to be arbitrary and capricious in granting certain trademarks in the past, like Uncle Ben's or Aunt Jemima or NWA, and then not granting Simon Tam's the slants?
I think the court thought that is one of the vices of the anti-disparagement provision. And Justice Kennedy made a similar point in his opinion, when he said that there is a reasonable debate, essentially, about whether Simon Tam is right, that his mark is educational and serves a sort of public policy purpose of taking the sting out of a racial slur, or whether people on the other side of that debate are right that merely perpetuating the existence of that slur is harmful to Asian Americans. And Justice Kennedy's view was the fact that there's a debate about that just shows that the government has no business taking sides in it. And I think, in part, as Ilya mentioned, Lisa Blatt's brief and her appendix describing the many trademarks that have been approved, including some that are sort of shocking, really made it hard to say with a straight face that this was made the government's case that much more difficult. I think the evidence is borne out that when you give government this sort of power, they're going to exercise it in arbitrary ways. And that's really why we have a First Amendment to begin with.
Very good. Let me make a final call for questions. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone if you have a question. Gentlemen, it appears that we have had our final question for the day. We've got a few minutes left, so let me come back to each of you and give you a chance to wrap up. We'll go in the same order that we began. Final thought, Michael Houston?
Well, just that I think, again, the court is making a very strong statement that when government is taking sides in a debate based on viewpoint, the government's going to lose. And so to the extent that you're a lawyer bringing First Amendment challenges, I think that's what Mattel gives you is a new opportunity to argue that government speech regulations are viewpoint discriminatory. And I think the message of this opinion is that the courts will look with that look at laws that do try to take sides on matters of public debate really, really rigorously. And I think that's a good thing for freedom of speech more broadly, for the commercial marketplace, for the marketplace of ideas. So I think Mattel in that way is a welcome decision, but exactly what it means will have to be sorted out in the lower courts given the fractured and somewhat opaque opinion.
As so often seems to be the case. A final thought, Ilya Shapiro.
Yeah, well, as it applies to the Redskins, I've always thought that they should just keep the name but change the mascot to a smiling red bliss potato. We'll see. As far as Packingham goes, look, you got to narrowly tailor. The government can certainly make restrictions when it has a compelling or a significant interest. Certainly preventing sex offenders from contacting minors is a strong interest, but you can't say, therefore, you can't effectively access the internet. And so these types of, where exactly to draw the line is a hard legislative determination, but you do at least need to tailor and not just have blanket restrictions. And that goes in the analog age as much as it is starting to in the digital one.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you both for joining us, especially on such short notice as these decisions come out. I want to thank the audience as well for your participation and for dialing in. A reminder to our audience about our next scheduled Teleform conference call. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. We'll be discussing Chevron deference. But until the next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.